I would like to think of myself as being a very independent person, but in order to do that, I have to ignore so many passages in the Bible. Passages like, He Himself gives to all life and breath and all things, and He made from one every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God. For in Him we live and move and exist. Doesn't sound like I'm independent, does it?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
So, Jack, we've been going through what I would consider to be rough, difficult, and cloudy waters of what is true. Does God determine what we do in our lives, or do we, or is there a blend of the two? In the last two programs, you've been defending the position that both I determine what goes on in my life and God determines that. But I think that's a paradox that lots of people just cannot put together. You had some great ways of explaining it. I wonder if we can go back to that, some of what you've talked about in the last two programs, do a little bit of review, and then add some to it.
Yeah, the key for me in my understanding came in trying to make a distinction between what it means for my choices to be caused or determined by God as a transcendent cause of my actions, as opposed to God causing my actions as what I call an ordinary cause. And what I mean by that is, if you coerced me into making a choice somehow, you somehow forced me, or let's go to science fiction, you injected me with some chemical that made my will a slave of your will, chemically enslaved my will to yours, well, that would be an ordinary cause. It would be like the puppeteer pulling the strings of the puppet and making the hands and legs move. It's coercive. It's a physical cause. And in ordinary causation, if you cause me to do something, then I'm not to be blamed for what I do. I mean, if you literally were to enslave my will to yours, then the one to be blamed for the crime that I committed under your control rests on you, not on me, because I become just a tool of
just
your will.
Just
a puppet, exactly. And we rightly understand that if I'm just a puppet, then I'm not accountable.
And should not be.
And shouldn't be, exactly.
We don't hold the puppet accountable for the movements that he makes.
Exactly.
I hold myself accountable as the puppeteer.
Yep. So, if God is the ordinary cause, just like the puppeteer is the cause of the puppet's movements, then we're right to object that, well, that would make me not accountable. That would make me not free. That would make me not really a person of my own, who owns my own choices and owns my own actions.
We should then stand up and rebel and say, wait a minute, this is not right, because indeed it is not.
Exactly, and it goes against everything that we know through our common sense, that I am in fact free and that I am in fact responsible, I am accountable. Those are my actions, my choices. So if that's what God's sovereignty would imply, then we should reject God's sovereignty, because that's clearly not true. But I stumbled upon a realization that the Bible is not saying that God is the ordinary cause of my actions. God is what I will call the transcendent cause of my actions. And I almost stalled there because my thinking was, well, how on earth would I know what it was like to be a transcendent cause of an action, and what are the implications of that, and what follows from that, because I've never been transcendent. And then it occurred to me, that's not true. I can be transcendent. I can be transcendent over the works of my imagination. And so I landed on the analogy of a novelist writing a novel. The author of a novel transcends the whole world and the whole reality of the novel that he's creating. And then it dawned on me, that's what the Bible is saying. God's relationship to us is very much like, not exactly like, but very much like, analogous to the relationship between a novelist and the novel that he's writing.
You mean the novelist to the characters that he writes?
To the characters, exactly. And really to the whole reality, the whole world that he's creating. He transcends that world. He's not a part of that world. He's outside of that world, beyond that world, above that world. And as I started thinking along those lines, a verse came to mind where Paul quotes a Greek poet, I think it's Euripides, if my memory serves me correctly, where Paul says, God, in whom we live and move and have our being. And he quotes that favorably, referring to God as the one in whom we live and move and have our being. It's exactly the relationship between the author of a novel and the characters in a novel. The characters in a novel, they live in the will of the author, they move within the will of the author, and in fact their very existence resides and dwells in the will of the author. If there were no author, there would be no characters. And if there were no author, there would be no movement of those characters. There would be no life to those characters. There would be no nothing to those characters. They have no substance apart from the will of the author of their being. I grew up, I think, with a very different conception of God, and that was God as this just amazing engineer who engineered this world and set it in motion, and then if he wanted to, he could have escaped to Pluto and just sat and rested on Pluto, and the whole universe would have just buzzed right along on its own power, on its own momentum, by its own will, to the extent that part of the creation has a will, that its own will is what drove the creation. And God had nothing to do with it once he set things in motion. And I didn't realize until I started to think through these things how much that was my image of our relationship to God, that I had substance in and of myself apart from God. I wouldn't have if he hadn't given it to me, but once he gave it to me, I was a substantive creature who just chugged along on my own, and I kept trucking on my own, and my will determined my actions and my fate, and God had absolutely nothing to do with me once he got me started.
But included in that theology at that time, would you have said, if I prayed to God, who seemed to be on Pluto at that time, would he come and help me?
I
could call him out of, of quietness?
Yeah, I didn't have a view of God as being remote and uninvolved, like the deists, perhaps. I mean, I thought that he could be as involved as he wanted to be, but he didn't have to be involved in order for my existence to go on. Well, this quote, in whom we live and move and have our being, seems to be suggesting my very existence the next moment is dependent upon this one who is the author of our being. That's a very, very, very different conception of God than I had. If God were to will me to not exist, I could pop out of existence the next moment. I could just disappear from this chair if God willed it, or didn't will my existence.
Well, I sure hope he doesn't, because I don't know what in the world I would do with this subject if you're not here.
So that's a very different conception of God. It seems to be the conception of God that Paul has when he quotes Euripides favorably. He seems to have this concept of God being this utterly transcendent being within whom this whole realm, this whole reality that we live, has any existence at all. Yeah, in other words, we are a figment of God's imagination, if you will.
You're now, not saying that we're not real, but we are very much a part of reality because he gave it to us.
Right.
And keeps giving it to us.
Right.
It's not as though, like, I birth my child and then my child's life is dependent on me. Well, in a sense it is, but in another sense, I could go away and someone else could take care of him.
Right, right. You could cease to exist and your child would go on living.
Right.
And my former conception is, if God were to die, of course that's silly, that's ridiculous, but if God were to die, then the universe would just keep chugging along as best it could. I think what the Bible is saying is, if God were to die, everything would cease to exist. Everything would pop out of existence.
And you're not suggesting that God is going to die
or that is even
a possibility.
Right.
What you're doing is making a point that everything, all of life, comes from God, is completely dependent on Him.
Yeah. And not just at its beginning, but its very continuation from moment to moment is directly dependent on the will of God. Now, I said, so in a sense we are a figment of God's imagination. Now, that sounds really horrible. Oh, you mean we're just imaginary?
It does. I quickly wanted to change that and did.
but I mean it seriously in this sense, and that is, am I saying that we're not real? Well, no, I'm not saying we're not real. I mean, we are just as real as we think we are. However, we're not as real as God. I mean, when we think about, again, the relationship of the novelist to the characters in the novel, the novelist is creating a real reality. That is to say, the characters in the reality of his creation are just as real as the other characters, and just as real as the furniture they use, and the houses they live in, and the cars they drive, and the air they breathe, and right on down the line. They're all equally real relative to one another. But somehow they're not as real as the author. And what I mean by not as real is, to say that, we have to change our conception of what we mean by real to what I think is a closer and more biblical conception of that. Plato, the pagan philosopher Plato, has helped me in this regard. Not that Plato has... Platonists have done more to distort Christianity than they have to help Christianity for the most part. But Plato was right about one thing, I think, and that is, the way to conceive of reality is to ask the question, how vulnerable is something to ceasing to exist? How vulnerable is it to popping out of existence? So Plato, for example, would say the table that is sitting in front of me is not really all that real, because you could take a match and burn it, or take an axe and chop it into pieces, or pulverize it somehow, and it would cease to be as a table. It just wouldn't be any longer. But the idea that gave rise to the table, the concept of a table in my mind, that doesn't go away when you destroy the table in front of me. That idea he called tableness. He says tableness doesn't go away just because you destroy a particular table. So tableness must be more real than any given particular table. And what he meant by more real is, it's a lot harder to get rid of tableness in the world than it is tables. They're still going to be around even when all the tables are gone. Tableness is still going to be there. And particularly, as later Christian thinkers said, if tableness exists in the mind of God, it's not going away ever. It's here. It's eternal. It's here to stay. It's a concept that is a product of God's mind. Now, that's a very different concept of reality than we have as modern people. Because as modern Americans, we tend to think of real as being substantive. It's concrete. If you punch it with your hand, it hurts your hand.
The table for us is more real than the concept of table.
Exactly. We have almost the reverse concept. Because tableness is abstract, it's invisible, it's immaterial. It's a spiritual thing, and that's not really real.
It's intangible.
Yeah, exactly. So we tend to think of the character in a novel as not being real because there's no substance to that character. It's just an idea in somebody's head, whereas I, the author, flesh and blood, am real. But Plato would have thought about it differently. He would have said, well, they're both real to their own degree of reality. The question is, which is more vulnerable of popping out of existence? Well, the product of my imagination is completely and totally dependent upon me being around there to imagine them into existence. If I go away, they go away. so they're less real than me. By analogy, God is real, yes, I am real, yes, but he's more real than I am. Because if God were to decide not to will me into existence, then there's nothing I can do to stay in existence. But who's willing God into existence? Whose will is his existence dependent upon? I think what the Bible is saying is nobody. God's existence is not dependent upon anyone or anything outside of himself. Therefore, he's not vulnerable of ever not existing. I mean, who's going to make him not exist? So in that sense, he's just so much more real than we are, in the same way that the author is more real than the characters in his book. So are we a figment of God's imagination? Well, in the sense that my very existence is dependent upon his will, yeah, that's exactly what we are. Does that make me less real than God? Yes, it does. It makes me less real than God. Does it make me less real than you? Well, no. You're just as much a figment of God's imagination as I am.
It doesn't make me less real than my experience of being real.
Right.
Or your experience of being real. It's the same, or maybe we're more real than we even experience, is
right.
My idea.
Right.
But what you're saying is relative to God, who is so transcends the reality that we know, he's more real.
Exactly.
So it doesn't take away what we know of ourselves, but it gives us more understanding of who God is.
Yeah, we must.
Well, it also kind of humbles me again.
Yeah, but we mustn't diminish. I'm not in any sense implying that we should diminish our concept of who we are, but we should have a more exalted notion of who God is. God is bigger than we have thought. We are not less than we have thought, but he is bigger than we have thought, more than we have thought. The term, as I studied philosophy, and I would get into medieval philosophy a little bit, there's this curious term that I kept running into. In Latin, it's ens realissimus, and it means the most real being.
Say that word again.
In Latin? I don't know if I can. Ens, which means being, realissimus, which means the most real being. To the medieval theologians, God was the most real being. And that's a phrase that's really stuck with me. That's exactly right. That's exactly what the Bible was teaching.
So that was their common understanding of who God was?
Yeah, it was a very common phrase that you run into.
That's how they said God, almost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The most real being.
Yeah. I think we need to understand, come back to that understanding of God, because we've lost that in modern culture. That's not our conception of God at all. We need to return to that. And if we return to that, then I think we begin to understand why Paul said, the one in whom we live and move and have our being.
And Jack, why is it so important that we understand this?
Okay.
What difference does it make in our lives to go through this whole process?
Well, because once we understand that, all these philosophical problems that we think we have dissolve. Let's take a novel, for example. If I were to write a mystery story as a novel with a murderer and a murder victim and a detective to hunt down the murderer and a judge and a jury to try the murderer and so on, I have determined the actions of everyone in that story. The murderer would not have murdered if I did not will him to do so. Now, did the murderer murder freely, however, of his own free choice? Well, absolutely, that's the way I wrote it. I mean, no one in the story made him do it. He freely chose to do it. In fact, I spent a whole chapter having him deliberate whether he was going to go through with it or not, resolving in his own mind, in his own will, in his own heart, whether he would do this evil thing or not do this evil thing. He was utterly and completely free from one perspective. That is, he was free within the reality that he was a part of. But from the standpoint of my will, which transcends that reality, of course he wasn't free. He was going to do exactly as I wrote the book, exactly as I wrote the script, and no differently. Couldn't deviate one iota from what I willed. So he was both free and not free at the same time, depending upon whether we're talking about freedom relative to his experience in the reality that he's a part of, or free relative to me and my transcendence of that reality. Makes all the difference in the world. Well, he's both free and not free, depending upon the frame of reference.
And last week, the free part, you defined a little bit more. I'm free from my environment. I'm free from other people forcing me to do something, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you could take my hand and make me hit the table.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, physically, I'm free to do as I want. I'm free of physics. I'm free of biology. I didn't inherit the absolute need to murder.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of freedom. I'm influenced by those things, sometimes to a great degree and sometimes not. So my freedom isn't complete freedom, but nonetheless there's a great deal of freedom. What you're saying I'm not free is in relationship to God's determining what's going to happen to the whole universe and individually to me.
Right, exactly. And it's this understanding of who God is as transcendent that allows me to understand that without contradiction. You know, otherwise, to say I'm free and I'm not free is a contradiction. But if I say I'm free in this respect, but I'm not free in this respect, then I'm not contradicting myself. I'm just more accurately understanding how I relate to God as opposed to how I relate to the rest of reality that I'm a part of. And I think that's how the Bible sees it.
Yes, when I'm listening to you, I can't say I'm altogether certain that you're right. It's a way to put together things that seem very contradictory in the Bible to me, like God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being, and it's really important for me to make choices, to be obedient to God.
Right.
He's telling me to do something. He's telling me to act on the knowledge that I have to behave in a particular way, and that then brings particular consequences. My actions make a difference, even all the way down to my own salvation.
Mm-hmm.
He stands at the door and knock, and I'm supposed to come and knock at the door. And so there's certainly a strong way in which I am supposed to come toward God, and yet he's the one that's authoring all of it.
Right.
Tough one to understand, Jack.
Right. Yeah. And I know no way to put those two things together. I know no way to resolve that tension apart from making this distinction that I'm making here between God and his transcendence and us as a part of the reality that he transcends.
But somehow they have to be put together because they're both taught.
Right.
They're both clear. And I think there's a lot of people on both sides of the fence who will go on one side and say, look, it's obvious that we're the one that determine what goes on in our lives. Look at all these verses. And they're right. They're very clear. They're very strong. They're very there. On the other hand, there's a lot that says that God is very much in charge of what goes on in our lives, and he is the author of all history. That is very clear. I think of in Egypt when they had all the horrible, what were they called, Jack?
Plagues
that occurred, and God just comes down and tells us how he interjects himself into history. And yet, the Pharaoh had complete freedom, in one sense, to make a choice to go in the direction he wanted to. And that's how history always is. God is determining something, and yet in the midst of it, we're making a lot of choices that look like they're entirely ours to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, in that account, you have the account alternating between the text saying that Pharaoh hardened his heart,
mm-hmm,
in order not to let the people go,
mm-hmm,
and then the next time it'll say God hardened Pharaoh's heart. The account doesn't seem to see any distinction between those two things. You can describe it as God hardening his heart. You can describe it as Pharaoh hardening his own heart. They're the same thing from the Bible's point of view. Any person hardening their heart is ultimately authored by God, and God is behind that and is ultimately transcendently responsible for it. But in the reality of that person's life, they were resolving in their own heart themselves, no, I'm not going to let these people go. And that was a free choice. No one was coercing him into being stubborn He was just determining himself that he was going to be proud and stubborn. And
because he wanted what he wanted and he was going to go after it.
Exactly.
And he wouldn't have said, God is making me do this. He was doing it.
Right.
And felt very autonomous, apparently.
Yes.
And even to the point where he came rushing after them and that's when they drowned.
Mm-hmm.
But he kept on thinking, okay, I'm gonna do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
Very directly he was going that direction.
Yep.
And yet God had a bigger plan up above that.
Yep.
Jack, we talked about this one before, but I think it's worthy to talk about each time we talk about God being the one that is the author of all. Why did God author in such suffering? Why didn't he soften, for example, Pharaoh's heart so that his whole army didn't drown in the sea? And the whole army may not have had hard hearts. They might have just been people who were in the army and part of that nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, if they didn't have hard hearts, they died physically. But that doesn't seal their eternal fate. Their eternal fate is based on other criteria. And God reserves the right as our creator to take our life anytime he wants to, one way or the other. If it's not dying in Pharaoh's army, it's an automobile accident or a food poisoning or something else. But he's going to take our life whenever he has deemed that my story here and now is done. He's going to take my life. God is not a murderer when he does that, because he's not presuming to be something he's not. When God presumes to play God, it's appropriate for him to do so. It's when I presume to play God that's the height of presumption. And the real evil in murder, there's many aspects to the evil of murder, but the ultimate evil of murder is the presumption involved. I am presuming to determine the span of someone's life out of my will, and I have no prerogative to do that. That's God's prerogative, not mine. So the fact that God takes our lives is not an evil. That's just part of what it means for him to be God.
It seems more evil, I think, that God would harden Pharaoh's heart.
Yes, exactly.
And that he doesn't.
It's much more devastating.
Much more. He has eternal hell.
Yeah.
Why would God harden people's heart?
Yeah. I think the closest that Paul comes to answering that is in Romans chapter 9. He says, you will say to me then, why does he still find fault? That is, well, let me start earlier. What shall we say then? There is no injustice with God, is there? May it never be. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So then it does not depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. For the scripture says to Pharaoh, for this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth. Already we see from the quote there a glimpse of what God is doing. When God hardens the heart of Pharaoh, Pharaoh is simply being a foil for God to demonstrate his power, his character, his justice, his loyalty to Israel. There are various aspects of God's character and his purposes that are being demonstrated, fleshed out, if you will, in history, and Pharaoh is simply becoming a foil for doing that.
A foil, a vehicle for it?
A vehicle, yeah. So then he says, so then he has mercy on whom he desires and he hardens whom he desires. You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who resists his will? Interesting. For who resists his will? That right there is something that very few modern Christians could write. Paul, without blinking, says, for who resists his will? You know, the common cultural assumption among us Christians is, well, all of us do. We all resist his will. That he gives us freedom to go the way we want to go, and he doesn't interfere in our lives. He pleads with us, he appeals to us, he tries to persuade us, he begs us, he exhorts us. But he never actually gets inside of my will and irresistibly moves it. Paul is saying exactly the opposite. Who resists his will? And then he goes on the contrary.
And he's saying, I can't resist his will. He's got this will, and there's no way I can go against it ultimately.
Right, exactly. Then he says, on the contrary, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? the thing molded will not say to the molder, "Why did you make me like this?" will it? Or does not the potter have a right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? What if God, although willing to demonstrate his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? And he did so in order that he might make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory. He's saying basically humanity is divided into two groups of people, what he calls vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, and vessels of mercy prepared for glory. The one is to demonstrate one aspect of God's character and his purposes, his loyalty to his covenant, the profound depths of the mercy that's a part of his character. And there's a certain class of people that are going to be the demonstration of that aspect of God's character. On the other hand, there's another class of people that are going to demonstrate his power and his justice and his majesty and his right to inflict wrath against evil and perversion and rebellion and falsehood. And he's going to do that. And that's a part of what he's going to accomplish in the world as well. Both kinds of people are a vehicle for God expressing something of who he is. Now, that's offensive to us, and I understand that. The whole idea that I'm nothing but a vehicle for God to show off part of himself is offensive to me. But I suppose it's taken me a few years, but I finally had to tell myself, get over it, Jack. It's true. I mean, that's exactly what you are. You are, when all is said and done, you're nothing but a character created by God. God is the main guy, not you. God is the center of the universe, not you. God is the one that this is all about, not you. And you're created to serve purposes of his own. He's not there to serve your purposes, Jack. As offensive as that is, it's the truth that I have to come to terms with. So you ask me why. Why in the case of someone like Pharaoh, why would God do something like that? Why would he harden the heart of one of his creatures? Because he's determined that he's going to be one of these vessels of wrath prepared for destruction to accomplish a part of the purposes that he's going to accomplish by making any reality at all.
And it sounds like the purpose that he has in mind for vessels of wrath and vessels of mercy are both, as you said, to reflect him, to kind of show him off. And in my mind, in our minds, that kind of sounds selfish. It sounds wrong. It sounds like God doesn't have very high character, that he would want to show off in that way, and he would use people for his own purposes, even to destroy them.
Yeah, it seems that way, but we have to think carefully about that, because if I kind of make myself the center of attention, the center of the universe, if I kind of promote myself to an exalted status, the thing that's inappropriate about that is that it's a lie, it's a falsehood, it's wrong. But if God were to say to the world, "Glorify me," it's not wrong in the same way, because it's not a lie. Why wouldn't I glorify the most glorious being?
What is glorious?
Exactly.
It's like saying, I had my family here this weekend, and my father was looking at my roses and smelling my roses and enjoying them and just reveling in them. And it was appropriate that he would do so, because they are beautiful and they are fragrant. They have a glory of their own that they've earned. That is just, if we can say, their character. And so it is right to honor what is honorable. It is right to give, to say something's awesome when it's awesome. To be thankful for something when it has been good.
Exactly. Even when we talk about the virtue of humility in human beings, a kind of false self-deprecation is not humility. And a recognition or a self-acknowledgement that I have certain virtues, or I have certain abilities, or I have certain strengths, is not a lack of humility, if it's true. You know, if I exaggerate my abilities or talents or strengths, then of course that's not humility because I'm out of touch with reality. But if something is just true, and I, as a matter of fact, acknowledge it as true, I'm not failing in humility. I'm just acknowledging what's true. Sometimes people, when they read the New Testament, are put off by Jesus and by Paul, because Jesus comes along and says, "Well, I'm the Son of God." And our
pretty big claim.
Pardon?
Pretty big claim.
Yeah, a big, huge claim.
Well, I think didn't they put him to death for that one?
Yeah, they did, actually. Yeah, they did. Because they wouldn't acknowledge it as true. But we tend to see self-deprecation as being somehow the way we need to go, or at least some people do, that that's the way we need to go. And Jesus, to being a perfect person, ought to have been self-deprecating. Well, why? He wasn't. He was just very matter-of-fact about it. I'm the Son of God. I'm the Son sent into the world to save the world of their sins. Do I have a Messiah complex? Well, I am the Messiah. If that means I have a Messiah complex, then I guess I do. But he's just very matter-of-fact about it. He's not making any claims above and beyond what's true. Hmm. And he didn't use that fact to... in any self-serving kind of way. He came to serve, not to be served. Even though he's the most magnificent human being that God ever created, in terms of his role and his character, he came to die for us, to sacrifice for us, and to serve us, not to snap his fingers so we'd pop a grape in his mouth because he needs to be served.
But he also,
that's humility.
I think what was also offensive to us, just as a sideline, is... He didn't only talk about the reality of who he was, but he also talked about the reality of who we are.
Right. Yeah.
And that was what continued to be very offensive to people then and now.
Because he popped all of our pretenses.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And he was very much into reality, the reality of seeing who he was and the reality of seeing who we are.
Right.
And that's what we're pointing to here. Is it wrong for God to want to bring... glory to what is glorious? No. It's right. It's real. And he's very much into reality. And Jesus really demonstrated that.
Right. Exactly.
That was kind of the bottom line of his ministry. Let's look at how things are. Let's not play around with what you want to make things look like. Let's look at what is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jack, these are very hard things to really grasp, because we live so much in this world, in this reality. We live so much inside of our own heads. We live so much in a smaller world than the world that God knows, the creation, or the way beyond creation that God knows. And so it makes sense, doesn't it, that we would struggle with these things,
yes.
We would get lost,
yeah.
That we would have such a hard time with them. And in fact, God knew that so well that he sent his Son to become a man like us so we could kind of get it.
Right, right.
That just acknowledges you guys aren't going to be able to get it. Your minds aren't going to be able to grasp this very well. So let me send you someone that's tangible, someone like you, who can explain it to you.
And the thing that I haven't appreciated for a long time is that the reality that we live in, this created reality, is not insignificant to God. It is so significant to God that not only did he send his Son, but he determined to become to himself incarnate in as the Son forever, eternally. And he's going to establish an eternal kingdom where Jesus, the Son of God, is going to reign as king forever and ever and ever. In other words, the incarnation is permanent. Well, that's putting a lot of stock in this reality that we're a part of, if he has so invested in it that he's going to become a part of it forever.
And so was so willing to suffer in it himself,
yeah, exactly.
To be a part of it. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Jack, because earlier you said, I just had to realize, something like, I just had to realize that I was just a part of God's plan to glorify him,
mm-hmm.
or other people to be vessels of wrath that show his power or other characteristics. And I thought, wait a minute, there's more to it than that in another sense.
Yeah.
And what's more to it is what you just said. We do have great significance to him also, just as people that he wants to love because he loves us as individuals. And he has an overall plan that he's using to glorify him.
Right.
Both are true at the same time.
Right, exactly.
Okay, Jack, there's a couple of more things that I think we need to bring up about your analogy of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to say this was something that came out of my own mind, and this is my objection, but you told me that the most common objection that people have to your analogy as God is the novelist,
mm-hmm.
as you would be the novelist, and the characters are us people,
mm-hmm.
The objection is, but the characters in the novel aren't real. They're only imaginary. And so it's okay for the novelist to do anything he wants with his characters because it's just a story.
Mm-hmm.
It's just on paper. No
right.
big deal.
Right. Yeah, that is the most common objection. I think the idea being that if I wrote this story with a murder in it, well, it's not a real murder. It's only an imaginary murder. So that's why we don't blame the novelist for the murder.
Well, that's why we're not upset with the novelist, because the novelist isn't hurting anybody that's real.
Right, exactly. But there's two answers to that objection. First of all, what I'm arguing about the analogy is that just as in the case of the novel, the murder is real as can be, relative to the rest of the novel. The jury who tries him, for example, is no more nor no less real than the murderer and the event of the murder that he has committed. They are equally real. And so the jury, it would be a really pretty silly and bizarre novel I wrote if I had the jury deliberating and saying, well, you know what, I think the author made him do it. I think the author of this novel that we're all in made him do it, so we can't find him guilty because he certainly is not accountable. The author made him do it. I mean, we would find that absolutely silly because it's not really fair to bring in the relationship of the novel to the author because everything is from the author, of course. But in terms of moral accountability, the question that needs to be asked is which character freely killed the murder victim? That's the only question. And they, according to the rules of the morality game, that murder needs to be held accountable in our reality. Any judgment that comes is going to be in that same reality. The same with us. Any eternal condemnation or eternal reward that comes is a part of our reality, not the reality of God, but our reality. And relative to this reality that we're all a part of, there's judgment, there's punishment, there's accountability, there's freedom. All that stuff is just as real as I am. And never mind that God is the author of all that, that doesn't change any of that. So that's true, that the murdered is just an imaginary murder relative to the transcendent author, but it's not an imaginary world in the world of the novel. It's a real murder in the world of the novel. And my sins are real in the context of the reality that I am in. They're not imaginary. The other thing is, Jesus himself taught us that just because an evil is a product of somebody's imagination doesn't make that person not accountable for it.
So you have murdered if you thought it in your mind.
Exactly.
You've committed adultery if you've committed adultery in your mind.
Exactly. And we could never use the excuse, oh, but I didn't really do anything, God. I just wanted to. I just thought about doing it. I was just desiring greatly that it be a reality, but I never really followed through on it. If we use that defense of the judgment seat of God, God's not going to be impressed. Because the passions of my heart are still shown to be evil and perverse and selfish and rebellious, whether I actually carry through with an action in the world that I live in or not. The fact that it's a part of my imaginary world all still reflects the evil of my character. So, a novelist, if he writes a novel where he has all kinds of perversity in it, and is reveling in the perversity that he is creating, I would argue that that novelist is accountable for that evil. He's not accountable for the deeds done in that imaginary world.
But it's a demonstration of his character. It's a demonstration of his heart.
Exactly.
Now, that same author may use murder as a way to demonstrate something that's good.
Judgment and justice and so on. Exactly.
Yes. And that wouldn't be an indication of a hardness of heart,
right,
or a rebellious heart, but only a person who's creatively using what he can to communicate a story or communicate a message that he wants to.
And to glorify ultimately what's good and right and just and
right,
true.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, something like pornography is evil, even though it's a product of somebody's imagination. It's evil because it is not appealing to what is good. It's appealing to what is evil and perverse.
What's wrong. And he is choosing that, freely choosing to honor that perversity.
Right.
And that is a reflection of his heart.
Right.
Now, before we run out of time, I want to bring up one other point that you've said to me previously. You said, in a novel, the same as in the world, the characters are free, even though they were a reflection of the author.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the right way to
the
say
will,
it?
The will of the author.
The will of the author.
Mm-hmm.
They are accountable, even though that is a reflection of the will of the author.
Mm-hmm.
And they reflect the author's character, which is what we just said.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's the story itself as a whole that reflects the character of the author. I mean, if I create an evil character in my novel, that doesn't mean I'm evil. It depends,
right.
It depends on how the story goes, what I am saying about the evil of that character.
Right.
That's going to be reflecting of my character.
Which is just what we right. were just talking about.
Exactly.
So can you go back to that and maybe can you clarify what I just said a little bit more? I feel like it wasn't quite there.
Well, what I'm saying is the people who reject this strong view of God's sovereignty and his determinative will over everything that I've been propounding, the people who reject that reject it for very good reasons, and that is they don't want to throw away human accountability, human responsibility, human freedom, my own personal ownership of the choices that I make and the actions that I perform and so on. They don't want to throw all that away, and their thinking is if we say God made me do it, then I'm no longer accountable and I'm no longer responsible, I'm no longer free. It's no longer my choices. It's God making me do it. And what I'm arguing is if this analogy holds, then we can have both. We can completely and totally acknowledge my own freedom, my accountability, my responsibility, my ownership of my own actions on the one hand, and at the same time still acknowledge and recognize that we're all creatures of a creator who transcends this reality and who wills everything into existence, including my own choices.
And
they can both be true.
And so what you would say is that although God wills all that is, and he ultimately determines all that is, I am very much accountable for my actions, for my behavior, for what I say, for what I think, for how my life goes.
Yeah.
That I have a heavy responsibility. So you're not saying, okay, I get out of the responsibility of my life and obedience doesn't matter. No way. Obedience matters. It matters incredibly.
It makes all the difference in the world. It defines my destiny, ultimately. My choice will determine my eternal destiny.
So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college? Or do you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask this question. What is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers, if you want to open the doorway to a good life, there is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center. McKenzie was founded on the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise, that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At McKenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College.
Jack, you know what I would like a lot of?
What would you like a lot of? Money?
I would like a lot of money. Actually, the reason that I think of that right now is because here we are at the end of our program again, and we're supposed to be talking to people about contributing to us financially. And you and I are sitting here thinking, scratching our head, how do we creatively do that? How do we ask people for financial contributions? And so that just came to my mind. I thought, I would really like a lot of money because I don't want to have to ask people for money, and I would just like to make this program go just out of my own financial contributions. But the reality is, I don't have enough money to make it go, and we really do covet, all of you listeners, to think about what you might do to financially contribute to this program. If we become independently wealthy, we'll let you guys know. The reality is, though, Jack, my daughter said to me when we're driving in the car, Mom, if you could have anything you want, what would you have? And, you know, I thought about it for a minute, and she said, it can't be anything about God, Mom. But, you know, I said, so do you want me to lie, Leah? And I just said to her, you know, I would really like to be a person who is wise. I would like to be a person who doesn't sin anymore. And she said, oh, but Mom, isn't that only going to happen in heaven? And she said, yeah. I said, yeah, it will only happen in heaven, but I'd really like that to happen now. I'd like that to happen more than having millions of dollars.
Did she buy it?
You know, I think she was really disappointed, Jack.
Yeah.
It's like, it was like, oh, gee, you are such a killjoy, Mom. I mean, she wanted me to tell her I'd like to have, you know, a condo in Hawaii or, I mean, if anybody wants to give me a condo in Hawaii, that would be great.
Well, it takes a certain amount of life experience to appreciate what's more important, what's more valuable. It's hard for children to understand that, I think.
Oh, impossible.
Impossible.
In fact, 15 years ago, I would have thought anybody that gave that answer, my answer, I would have thought really underneath, they were just giving me a bunch of malarkey.
Yeah, yeah.
You too? It takes a lot of life experience to finally go, oh, I get it. That's what I really want.
Yeah.
Because that would solve everything. To be, not to be a sinner and to be wise, we'd have it.
Yep.
We are truly serious about the need for financial support. We're going to keep asking you guys every week, and we hope every week you will think about the possibility of supporting us financially, in a big way or in a small way. We do need your financial contributions, and we do thank you for even considering this as a possibility.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mckenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of McKenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to McKenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, by 41-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.